The idea was we wanted to kind of a little discussion with some of the people who are, I would argue, at the forefront of kind of theory within the anti-globalisation movement, within some of the movements that have been really important in the last 30 years. We're going back to the late 60s, I think, really, and have provided a lot of theoretical advances, I believe, personally, in looking at, like, commons, globalisation, and enclosure, especially new enclosure in the world. So I'll just kind of introduce everybody. So this is George Kafensis, who was speaking yesterday, who's from the University of Southern Maine, and Peter Linebaugh, who's from the University of Toledo in near Detroit, and Massimo De Angelis, who's just written a great book called Beginning of History, and also David, which is there, who's from University of East London, isn't it?
Yeah.
And David Graeber, who I didn't know was on the panel till last night, and I didn't know he was on the panel. I met David a couple of years ago in New York, and he's quite famous within the anarchist movement, and certainly outside of that as an academic and anthropologist. So,
as noted, I didn't know I was doing this 12 hours ago or so. So it might be a little rough, but let me try to. I was thinking about what to say on this panel. I picked up the Magna Carta Manifesto, a book I've been waiting to see for years. And often when I look at books, I look at the last sentence because it always often tells you something. I used to sometimes look for the first word, but it's often "zot" or something uninteresting like that. But in this case, actually, I opened the first word, and it's communism. And I thought, wow. Maybe I'll use that as my text. Communism. I think that, it's a really interesting word, and it's a word that people, often avoid for obvious reasons, because of certain types of association. But I have myself been thinking about it recently in relation to commons and how we talk about commons. And because it strikes me that it's a word that's been twisted away from its most interesting usages, and it would be useful to think about it in a different light. So, this bears on a project that I've been doing for some time, which has to do with reconfiguring the idea of exchange, gifts, commodities. There's a huge anthropological literature on this, which I've been engaged with as an anthropologist for many years. And there's always been a feeling that it's relevant and bears on really important questions of social possibility, of economic possibility, that for full record of how other economies have been organized has bearing on how we can reorganize our own lives in a more somewhat less destructive way. But part of the problem is there's been a rather... people have used really rough tools intellectually in terms of how they talk about these things. And in particular, there's a whole discourse on either if you talk about the idea of primitive communism as it occurs in people like Engels, or people talk about gifts and gift economies. There's a sort of notion that once upon a time there were these societies that were based on non-capitalist, non-market principles, and nowadays we have like a market society, a capitalist society. A lot of it pulls on the work of a French anthropologist named Marcel Mauss, who wrote a book on the gift. And people talk about the gift and gift economies and how can we recreate an economic system based on gifts rather than on capitalism. And I've been interested in the idea of this project for some time. But I think that people who take it up often completely miss the point of what people like Mauss are really getting at. So I wanted to propose a way of thinking about exchange, and not just exchange, the possibilities of transactions between people that might throw the whole idea of commoning and the management of commons in a different light, and also especially the idea of communism. Because what I think is really interesting about people like Marcel Mauss and his work on the gift is that it's not really an argument about, there used to be societies like this and now there are societies like that. What's really interesting about it is that it actually takes the opposite tack and argues that almost all economic and social possibilities are simultaneously available to us. He argues, for example, well, the whole argument about the gift just is, in a way, his initial question is, why is it that, you know, if you get some free market economist and take them out to dinner and show them a great time, they'll feel that they're sort of less of a person if they can't, like, take you out later. You know, why do they feel this obligation to return a favor or a gift, despite the fact that, according to their own theories, they should say, hey, I got something for nothing, great, and go home. So, like, the spirit of the gift sort of lives on, you know, even though our society tells us it's not supposed to. And, in fact, what most argued, he had a really interesting take on primitive communism, which comes along with that. He argued that communism, rather than being, you know, something that once existed in the far past and that might exist at some point in the future, is something that is absolutely always present in all societies. In a way, it's the basis of societies. And in fact, he coined phrases like individualistic communism, which sounds like a complete contradiction in terms. But what he actually meant by that was that, well, what is communism? We think of it as always in relation to ownership. Like, if there's collective ownership of something, that's communism. He said, well, you know, you can have collective ownership of some land, for example, but one guy's actually managing it, and it's completely under his control, or you could have something where, in theory, title is individual, but in fact it's collectively administered. What you have to look is actually at rights of access, who gets to do what to whom and why. It says, and if you look at it that way, well, communism is simply relations of from each according to their ability to each according to their needs. When that's the regulative principle, in a form of cooperation, interaction, that's a communistic relation. Like, we're all communists with our best friends, basically. So you can actually trace out relations of, like, individual sort of dyadic relations of communism throughout any society, and some more than others, but it's always there. And, you know, this occurred to me that there's something very important here, because, first of all, it shows that, you know, even we talk of ourselves as a market society, we act like communists most of the time. In all sorts of, you know, whenever we're having a conversation, we're acting like communists. Whenever we do a task together, we tend to act like communists. I mean, when people working for a capitalist firm are actually engaged in a project together, you know, somebody says, hand me the wrench, the other guy doesn't say, yeah, well, what do I get for that? You know, I mean, if the guy needs it and you have it, you give it to him. It's a communistic organization. So in a way, all capitalism is actually parasitical off of forms of communism, because it's the only really practical way to organize joint activity. So I started thinking about this, and there's a whole literature on the gift. And actually, I came up with this 27-point typology, which I can't tell you right now. But if you actually try to parse, and I think this would be a really useful project for us to get more specific terms when we think about how forms of exchange interrelation actually work. It seems to me that when people talk about the gift and extra-commercial, basically people use the gift for any type of exchange or other transaction which is not a commodity transaction. So, you know, if it's not for money or barter, so you're trying to get as much as possible from somebody, then it's a gift. In fact, what we call gifts are broken down into different types of transactional logic that operate completely differently. We tend to muddle them together and confuse them. And I think distinguishing them makes it a lot easier to see what's really going on in the world. Like most, I think that all of these principles are constantly present in any given human society. And one is communism, communistic relations, which are based on, well, to give the very briefest summary, communistic relations are based on principles of solidarity and mutual aid, from each according to their ability to each according to their need. Relations of exchange are based on reciprocity, some idea of tit for tat. And then there's hierarchical relations, which are not based on forms of reciprocity at all, but are based on precedent. So in the case of hierarchical relations, when you assume that there is no inequality between two people, then every action that you do sort of sets a precedent for what people will do in the future. Like, if you give money to a charity, right? I once gave money to the United Farm Workers in America. I didn't hear the end of it for 20 years. They kept sending me more solicitations, right? It's not like somebody's going to give you something back, right? They're just going to ask you again. It will be a precedent. And give candy to a child, it'll be the same thing. Because there's no assumption of equality. Reciprocity is when you have people have a certain distance but trying to maintain their equality. So, you know, the reason why you want to pay somebody back if they gave you, bought you dinner is to show that you're equal to them in status. But those relations can be broken off at any point. So that very often you will, in fact, if you give somebody back exactly what they gave you, then that means they don't want anything further to do with you, because it becomes like a commodity transaction. You're paying them, you know, high. So in a lot of societies, you never pay people back exactly what you owe them, because that would be like an insult, saying you don't want to know them anymore. So you always give them a little bit more, a little bit less. I call this like attenuated communism through minor debt. But it's one of my 37 categories. Yeah, there's a lot of that. I can't go into all of them. But and I thought this is really interesting to sort of de-link the notion of communism to an idea of commons, and then to bring it back again, hopefully. Because we are assuming something like, you know, real property, land, something like that, which is very important. But if you look at relations which are more flexible, involving labor, help of various kinds, exchange of movable things, you can find a lot of the different possibilities. So essentially, communistic relations are ones in which you assume a permanent mutual commitment. And the logic of a communistic relationship is one where you don't keep account of who's given what to whom. And that's the basis of it. Because you assume that person will always be there and will always be available to you. So in that sense, you can have individualistic communism between people. Very often you have it between social groups. At least, so that, for example, moiety systems, in anthropology we hear about this all the time. I'm probably running out of time, but you'll have a village divided into two halves, and they each have, there's a famous book actually called Your Own Pigs You May Not Eat. Because sometimes you can only get food from the other side, you can only marry people from the other side of the village. Often, if somebody dies, only they can bury you, or something. Now, of course, if nobody's going to keep count, well, outside of the village, we buried 12 of their guys last year, and they only buried 7 of ours. That's not fair, right? I mean, it would never occur to you to keep count. It's something you do when you need. But the larger the groups, the more that communism tends to attenuate, to the point where there's a kind of baseline communism in any society. Even the most alienated, impersonal society such as our own, if A, the need is great enough, or B, the cost is small enough, everybody's a communist. Like, you ask for a light, or somebody's drowning. You know. But what point that goes depends on various social circumstances. So you can have societies where, I believe we're hearing about this about Mesoamerica, you know, if you're stopping at night, you're allowed 3 ears of corn from anybody's field. 4, you're a thief, they kill you. But, you know, 3 is fine. Everybody deserves 3. To points where, you know, societies where, say, refusing food to somebody is actually pretty much socially impossible. So you have to figure out. Actually, there's all these stories about that. There was in New Zealand where there was this one famous guy who was like always hit people up whenever they had really good food, and nobody could refuse him. So he's this famous really sort of hanging around the seashore. If somebody caught something really good, he'd come, oh, I really like that. So eventually, like people after about 5 years of this, people formed a war party and killed him. They couldn't actually say no, right? So these are different modalities of communism, which I think are interesting field to investigate in their own right. Exchange, on the other hand, becomes a sort of tit-for-tat nature, applies equivalence of value of things in a way of establishing social equality, and which I could go into great detail, but I won't. But it's often, you know, it becomes a way, so communistic relations can either devolve into relations of exchange, or relations of exchange can become communistic through certain patterns. So that, for example, there's a kind of form of testing. Like in Madagascar, it's very common you have a blood brotherhood with someone to establish a business partnership. So as to establish, and you have to test it out. So you're moving from a sort of exchange relation to sharing communistic relation. The first thing you have to do is set up a system where I can refuse you nothing, you can refuse me. So people always test it out by sort of seeing how much they can demand from the other guy and get away with it. You know, give me your pet dog. But knowing that they can do it back to you. So you have this sort of contest of outrageous demand become ritualized. But that's also something that can happen if, like, relations of communism break down and turn into exchange, going the other way. And I think it's important to bear all this in mind because we often confuse communism with one type of relationship, which I think are actually a form of hierarchical relationship. Again, relations in which it's... no assumed equality exists, and therefore, rather than there being any question of hierarchy, of reciprocity, it's a question of precedent, and you're sort of negotiating what you can get away with by precedent. Because the resultant idea of redistribution, of redistributive economies, is get confused with communism. But in fact, what you have is a kind of continuum between theft, which has no social relation, kill people or just take their stuff, sneak around, to the pure gift, where you're at, utter total altruism. Either one are based on principles of sort of surreptitiousness, where you can have no social relation whatsoever on an ongoing basis. So if you want to look at a true, like there's an Islamic tradition that if you want to give a really true gift to someone, you have to sneak into their house when they're not looking and leave it so they don't know who gave it. So it's almost like theft in reverse, right? But in between those, there's a whole series of different modalities of which one is redistribution. But when people talk about these giant hierarchical redistribution as sort of more model for communism, and you can argue that all communist states are based on this, but it's also what they don't usually point out is these things are based on aristocratic societies and are the other side of plunder and theft. Normally, when you steal enough stuff, the first thing that you do is start redistributing at least some of that. And this is almost automatic. I have a Japanese friend who pointed this out that after the big earthquakes in Osaka, the first people out on the street with relief are always the Yakuza, the mafia. It's just an automatic thing if you were a robber baron to start doing this or to legitimate yourself. So these are just examples which I could endlessly go on about. But I think that one of the first things that would help in our discussion of what a commons is and how they're organized is to start distinguishing the different underlying principles that actually do operate within these systems. So I will throw that out as sort of direction we might want to think about when we go on from here.
Okay. It's me.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Good.
First of all, thank you for inviting me here. Great opportunity to meet old friends and make new ones. And especially a panel on commons is, of course, a great opportunity to do something in common. Right. It's not easy to talk about commons. It's difficult. It could be easy, but I think it is difficult. And instinctively, you see, I my work, I've talked about commons or in different ways, but I always felt that I approached the question of commons somehow starting from the enclosures of the commons, or the damned enclosure of the commons. And there is a reason why we are kind of, more instinctively prone to first look at the enclosures, is because it is in the very moment we are up against a social force that encloses and in this way disrupts community and does real damage to real people and to real environments. That we recognize, oh damn, we had a commons there. We take it for granted otherwise. David mentioned, there are many aspects of our lives which are communistic, but we don't think about them that way until someone comes with a gun or whatever means to enforce it, and you say, hey, actually, we had something that right there. Maybe it was not perfect. Maybe we should have worked through those relations with, you know, in different ways, but we had something. Okay, we don't want to romanticize commons, but, you know. So I also, in this case, I want to then start from enclosures, but you know, I won't spend much time of it, but we have to recognize what is the, you know, the main, what has been the main discourse, especially in the last 50 years, which gives somehow some reason for enclosing commons. And that is the famous argument by Harding, Gerrit Harding in 68, of the tragedy, or the so-called tragedy of the commons, where Harding writes a paper in Science where his argument is simple enough. Assume there is some graceland and assume there is a bunch of farmers, herders, who go with their own cattle, and of course each one of them has a self-interest to feed as much as possible their own private cows or sheep or whatever. And of course, if everybody, as they do, follow their self-interest, then the commons is depleted. That is the tragedy. The argument led, in turn, a policy implication, which became very, very strong during the neoliberal era, but that's not new in terms of, you know, the history of capitalism, but certainly that, you know, Harding's argument allows to strengthen the motivation for doing so. And the policy implication, of course, is they have to take the commons and privatize it. And or, the alternative, have the state to allocate. Now, let's not forget that the state and the market are here two poles of the same contradiction. An external power coming in and taking our resources and turning it into something for different purposes than for the original commoners' ideas of what those resources. And this Harding's argument is very important for us to recognize, which has been actually subjected to a very long criticism now from anthropologists, people studying the actual working of the commons in reality. And the main criticism that we can make of that argument is that he leaves out an important aspect. And what he leaves out from the story of the commons, for which you can then say there is a strategy, is the verb that Comrade Peter come up in his book, which is the fact that there is a community who does the commoning together. The commons are turned to a verb, commoning. There is a real-life community who set the rules of access, who even find different ways to, we have to use this word because that's when we're talking about commons, we have to monitor each other in certain ways. Certain times, minimize the need for monitoring, as I try to explain later on. Other times, there is need for monitoring. The point is different set of, they enforce rules. The rules that they themselves decide to access that commons. Okay, so what is very important for us to understand is that every commons has a community, and a community who empower themselves to make the rules of the game among themselves. How to access the commons, how the allocation process occurs, who does the work, and what, you know, what's the work like, etc. Okay, so that is a very important point that I think we have to remember whenever we think about commons, or even when we think about reclaiming the commons, because when we are talking about reclaiming the commons, we also have to think about reclaiming the communities. How do we organize our relation to the commons? Okay, it's not just the commons, it's the commoning as well, which is fundamental for us. As I said, the argument, though, or the tragedy of the common, leads to enclosures. And one of the things that my comrades and myself have been talking about in the case of the new enclosures and the midnight notes, the idea is that enclosures are actually unlike what traditional Marxism tell us are an ongoing process happening in capitalism. Okay, in its own historical dynamic. And this for two reasons. One is that capital has a boundless drive to accumulate and turn everything into commodity, and you can do that only by turning some commons into commodity. And the other one is we are not just victims of that. We are agents as well. We fight historically, and our fight actually produces commons. In fact, the struggles are only possible through commons, through the creation of waves of political recompositions that create commons, and also, succeed in obtaining resources as commons. Okay, and a new phase of capital strategies always aim at enclosing the old thing that granted or gave the worker class the possibility to empower itself vis-à-vis capital. So the enclosures are ongoing, enclosures and commoning are ongoing dynamic, and the question for us is, okay, how do we then clarify ourselves in such a way that we say, okay, we want to stop this ongoing dynamic, we want to stop the type of development of the development of capitalism which is based on ongoing co-optation of struggles, disruption of commons, and vice versa. There is another dimension of commons. I should have said at the beginning that what I'm presenting here is a series of thought that I would like to have throwing in the discussion. Some of the stuff I'm not clear myself. I'm working on some ideas, and one of the things that we hear when we talk about commons generally is always like commons is only outside capital, and to a certain extent it is. But is it also, and that's why we talk about reclaiming the commons, but always in a sense, like knowledge as commons, or the word global commons, as George will address this question of global commons. But one of the things that is somehow puzzling for us, we have to find a way to deal with, is that actually capital uses the commons all the time. He uses them in a particular way. The market, global markets, is a form of commons. When Marx talked about social labor, which happens in a capitalist form, we are talking about social production. It's production in common, but it's a common which is for want of a better word, a fucked up commons. A common which pit everybody against one another, recreate hierarchies, main hierarchies of which is between wage and unwage, but, divides the world in these hierarchical ways. It is, though, a common. Reclaiming the commons would mean also at the same time, not simply reclaiming what is already potentially threatened by commodification, but also reclaiming the commoning and the forms of commoning that we are going through every single day to the extent we are working within capitalist relations. And that is, another aspect I would like to throw in within the debate. Another issue is the commons, the label is, and capital operational awareness. just to put it, an illustration. I heard that in Italy Berlusconi won again. Okay, and I heard his news program, his debate on the radio between you know, the right and the left, the right who won, etc. What I was kind of hit by discourse of the right in those debates. They were talking about labor. They were talking about how to be more competitive. They were talking about all the, you know, how to grow the economy, how to grow better and more, faster and all that. But one of the things that struck me is that their own discourse was purely on the problematic of the daily life in the capitalist commons. Their questions were, how do we deal with the shirkers? How do we deal with those that deserve more? They were, you know, in terms of how do we reward those who deserve more in terms of merit? In other words, their own discourse, however we dislike it in the context of capitalism, we know what deserving or shirking means. Shirking as a refusal of work tradition, we all understand the class meaning of shirking. It's not. But I was struck by the fact that their own discourse was about thinking about really how do we do the commoning and how do we improve the commoning from their own perspective, which is capitalist commoning. But it's a commoning. Our public discourse, on the other hand, only purely perhaps want the common, but we shirk away from discussions about our own common. And this, I think, is one of the main problems we have, because we will never be able to build a political community in the sense of being a political community which is able to generate sufficient power to contrast capital without addressing our own issues of commoning. And I'm just putting, you know, things like these as again problematic issues to discuss. Another issue is again relation between commons and commoning in a more kind of analytical sense. Commoning is a verb, commons is not. Commons is a pool of resources. In the literature of commons, in fact, commons are called common pools of resources. But they are related. Where is this book? I want to read a very short sentence from this book by Eleanor Ostrom. It's a new institutionalist. Her theoretical frame is very positivistic, but she reviews thousands of cases of real life commons to see how they actually operate. Okay, it's extremely interesting. I just wanted to read that is very, very small descriptive case of the commons in Switzerland, in Turbel Common in Switzerland, Pastures Common. The user are the main decision-making unit. There is an immediate link between a user of a resource and political power, you know, at that level. The main decision-making unit. They have to decide on all matters of importance, and they're granted a considerable autonomy. They can set up statutes and revise them. They can set limits, etc., etc. It can also be said that the user organization are nested in a set of large organizations, which is, you know, the village, the region, and then the region, the canton, etc. So the nesting of the various commons put the question of scales in perspective. Now, I was thinking when I was looking at these examples that, you know, they all have these patterns. I mean, they actually exist in commons, which some of which have survived for thousands of years, and they are north and south of the globe. They have this thing. On one hand, there is a common pool of resources. That's the commons. On one hand, there is a series of practices. For example, in the case of forestry, selection of input. Which tree do we cut? Okay? Then, once that has been done by certain institutions decided by the commoners themselves, then is how do we organize our labor in common? How do we put labor in common? Okay, the other aspect of the commoning. Then how do we distribute? And it's very interesting actually that many cases distribution, labor is in common, that everybody brings their own energy together, and the distribution in many cases is by lottery. And this to me is extremely insightful. You know, I don't know in which case the lottery would fit in your classification.
Depends on who's administering.
Okay. Well, I assume that the lottery is something which is, as in this case, is decided by the community itself, because in essentially you cut the trees, you put the work in common, then you organize a stack of wood, and who decides which stack goes yours? Throw a lot. Let's see. You know, if we have similar. But then it's very interesting what closes this loop of commoning is the fact that the community itself says, well, there is a limit to what we can harvest. That's it. We are finished for this year. The harvesting is next year. And that limit is itself the precondition for the next round to select the next year again what other trees to cut. Now, if one analyzes the process of the commons as the relation between the resources and this loop of working together and making decisions, with how it goes on under capital administration, every single step is in capital is mediated by market, disciplinary market, who set one against the other, and by, of course, power relations at the point of production. While here everything is, the point I want to make here at this point, to cut it a long story short, is that we need somehow find a way to keep distinguished but linked one another the question of commons as common pool resources and commoning, because we do a lot of commoning with little resources. So the question becomes then different movements. How do we access the commons to make those commoning flourishing? How do we increase the resources? What, you know, that's the demand you put on the state. That's how we could expand the realm of common pool resources and making a kind of a political objective. The very last two points, and then I finish, because I'm sure I've gone beyond the 15 minutes here, is two other points related to the commons. One is that commons, if one looks at the history of the relation of commons within capitalism and capital as a social force of enclosure, commons have also not just being the object of enclosures, but also the source of much power to refuse capital's discipline. And that is something that we need to keep in mind. The most recent example, the welfare state was born as a strategy to put people back to work at the beginning of its story in the post-war era. It churns at the end when capital decides to get rid of it as, in fact, a big, conditions of power for the struggles of the 60s and 70s. You know, you had the power to refuse capitalist work, with extreme power. So the commons, even if to a certain extent is a factor because it's the welfare state in capitalist hand, had a condition of empowering. Silvia Federici makes this the example of how the community had power, community based on women, women commoning of their own skills and expertise in the communities provided them with a great power of vis-a-vis men and the state. There is many other examples. The point is we have to understand commons strategically, not simply as a final whatever, but as a conditions of class power. And finally, if the commons is a condition of class power, then we have commons, there is always a commons and a commoning. The commoning open up the question of political recomposition, because when we're talking about commoning, we're talking about recomposing subjects across a wage hierarchy, meaning claiming resources means at the same time different people have different priorities, and how we articulate these priorities, different movements have different priorities, and how we articulate those priorities. So political composition here, it becomes is the commoning. It's a moment of commoning, of articulating new values. So I'm just throwing those buzzwords, and you know, I can do 15 minutes.
Can you explain that last bit again?
The recomposition.
Sorry?
Can you explain the last bit again, the recomposition?
Yeah, what I want to say in the last bit is our condition of our condition is a vertically is a wage hierarchy, essentially, and every movement at whatever level of this wage hierarchy is faced with the possibility of being co-opted and someone left out. Okay, I mean the Keynesian deal, which was of course a victory of the working class in the north, in the form of a capitalist deal, meant at the same time the bombing of Vietnamese farmers. That was part of how the deal was organized globally. What I'm trying to say is that we have to think a commoning that cut across the wage hierarchy, that understand that our condition is a wage hierarchy. And that's, a big challenge, I suppose.
Okay, so thank you. And I too am happy to be here and look forward to another few days of being with you all. In my presentation concerning the commons, I'd like to first say what a very important moment in the development of this notion. Okay, we're now getting a more refined conception of the commons, because at first, let's say 15 years ago when we started talking about the commons and enclosures and so on, it was a weapon that it was like almost a kind of shiny brand new weapon against neoliberalism, because the neoliberal approach, which is sometimes put into the slogan, the earth is for sale, everything is for sale, all things are commodities, and the neoliberal approach is to impose that on the world, the alternative was always seen as state property instead of private property. Okay, and what we began to see, the people around this table, and yourselves too, was that in fact that wasn't the alternative. It wasn't just private property and state property. There was another way of organizing social relations, resources, that evaded both those alternatives and made it possible to begin to articulate another political alternative. And that was a great development, and we began to see class struggle in a more complicated way. It's no longer a struggle between wages and profits alone, but in fact we saw another axis in the class struggle, because we began to see that in fact there was a struggle around the separation from the means of production and the means of subsistence and its union, and the distance between separation and union, the distance between the means of production and subsistence and the working class, is never a fixed matter. It didn't happen once that it broke and will always remain broken, the way sometimes you can interpret Marxism as saying. No, we actually saw that many times there was a reunion between working class and the means of production and subsistence. And that distance between working class and means of production and subsistence was moving always, and it was a measure of class struggle, just as the wage was a measure of class struggle. And their coordination was a matter of a new sophistication in our understanding of class struggle, which I think was very important for us, and I think was helpful. But in the early 1990s, once we began to establish this view, we began to hear from the other side a similar discovery. Okay? In other words, neoliberalism, which was beginning to find its, on the one side, its deification in the World Trade Organization and many of these large-scale worldwide trade deals, was also beginning to recognize that there were a lot of resistance to the neoliberal agenda. Okay, so increasingly, the neoliberal theorists, those who began to notice this struggle against neoliberalism, against the enclosures, as we call them at that time, began to rethink this notion of the commons more or less around the same time that we developed our notions. In fact, there's something called the International Society for the Study of Common Property, which was formed in 1990, just around the time when we were doing our work, interestingly enough. And Eleanor Ostrom was, I believe, the president, the first president of this operation. So, in fact, what we began to see also, if we were studying World Bank documents in the early 90s, about, let's say, agriculture in Africa, was, in fact, that the World Bank was arguing, well, actually, communal tenure was not so bad, all right? Because they began to realize that, in fact, the attempt to privatize land in Africa was not going very well. So they began to say, maybe the commons was useful to us, at least as a transition, right, to help the process of privatization. We might first need to allow for, and in fact help develop, a little bit of this communal land tenure. And in fact, increasingly throughout the 90s, we began to see commons popping up. It became I don't know about here, but in the United States, the commons became a real estate term. Right, many of the malls became considered commons. Many new housing developments, in fact, gated communities call themselves commons. I'll show you. And in fact, when you go, like at my university library, I go to my library and I discover that now it's called the information commons. Okay, it's everywhere. In fact, it's quite interesting to see how the terminology of commons has been taken up by capital. Okay, so in understanding this bifurcation, this duplicity of the commons, you might say, we began to recognize that, in fact, capital had an interest in the commons in the way that the working class has an interest in the commons. They're very different interests, of course. But the capitalists began to understand, for example, that the firm, right, the basic unit of capitalism, is their own little commons, right? It's their own way in which they organize their structure and their life, because, in fact, within the firm, a lot of the organization is communistic, as we know, right? So, in fact, it's the way in which this communism within capitalism, in fact, helps the market. Helps, in fact, if the person with the wrench had to pay the person with the screwdriver, then, in fact, production will crash. Okay, that's clear. So capitalism had a very wide-ranging interest that, in fact, it began to grow in the 1990s into the early 21st century. We, of course, recognized that the commons was quite crucial from an anti-capitalist point of view. And, in fact, increasingly we saw that there was no way that the anti-capitalist movement could develop without increasing the scope of the commons. But then we began to, and this is something that I'd like to bring up in a kind of problematic way. We began to hear, especially after Kyoto in 1997, a notion that you can find earlier in the literature of the notion of the global commons. Okay. And we have this, and that notion was, at first, you'll find it mostly in the literature of the World Bank and of the United Nations. It's the notion, and we must recognize that. I gave a talk, what was it, last night, about John Locke, and I urge you to think about these early thinkers, capitalist thinkers. They too had the notion of a global commons. Okay, they thought the oceans were global commons. Okay, they thought, John Locke, for example, thought the Americas was a huge common. Right, and they used this notion because they wanted to appropriate this common. They wanted to appropriate. So when we hear the notion of global commons, we have to be, as always, recognizing that there's a two-sided character to this notion. And it's very important because the capitalists conceive of themselves as global citizens because, in fact, increasingly, they flow with their money. And as far as they're concerned, their money is everywhere. Okay, they move everywhere. So they're already thinking, actually John Locke thought 350 years ago, that he was a global citizen, that the silver crowns are going to go around the planet, and with them go the capital of the English bourgeoisie. Okay, but capital already thinks, and in fact can make some claim to the global commons because they consider themselves a global community. The community of capitalists is a kind of global community, and so they're claiming the global commons. Our problem, when we use that term, because we do use it, is that we don't yet have, in an embodied way, in a community, as Massimo says, there's no commons without community, right? We don't have yet a global community, that a global set of commoners to make that kind of claim. So we're now in a very difficult moment because we're watching, for example, this whole discussion of climate change and the legislation, action around climate change. We're watching this development in an extremely ambiguous way, and because we're concerned that we're going to be politically disarmed. And in fact, used, as we saw the anxiety of what happened, was it 3 years ago now, 3 summers ago, in Scotland, right? At the G8 in Scotland. Like the sense that our movement was actually being used against itself, right? Here too, with this climate change story, that we too have to again be very clear that the climate change of the global and concerning the global commons that is now being dealt with is clearly being dealt with in a way that is to lead to the development of capital, not to the development of our class. And how we are going to change the dynamic of the story of the global commons is something that we have to think very carefully about, because it's going to be a very treacherous period with these terms. So I will. With that, I hope to turn it over to you.
On the note of treason.
on the note of the challenge that we face.
Heading off for treason, yeah.
So that the World Bank does not...
Yeah, you got to tell us how.
You got to tell us how. You asked for the last slide. I hand it to you. Hand it off, right? This is like a relay race. Okay, Dean. Go to the end. Go sprint to the end now.
Now the most important part. Yeah.
Oh, Pete, no. Come on, no. No, that's actually our whole problem, right?
Hey, hey, hey.
And you will open questions on that. These guys will help us out.
Well, you know, where my thinking started, like, all these people here, I and you all, you have been to a Chiapas, right?
So,
you are part of the Zapatista Encuentros of, and here was an international, Dave, Massimo, George, Raj. You have made with your feet a movement to some other part of the globe. And this globe, I think, gets in our way, in our thinking. And I think of what you did. Like with Massimo, he sat me down under St. Mary LeBeau's in London. And we were having lunch with Michaela. And he said, Peter, I learned about human dignity. And that's been with me ever since, you know. The Mary LeBeau's, the Cockney Londoner, was transformed by this. Really. To me, it was a message mediated, you know, through Italy, but it came from Chiapas. It was a very lasting gift, and it comes from an international. We've had internationals in the past, and each one of them has failed. I believe in war. First one, the Franco-Prussian War, the second one with World War I, the third one, World War II. Yeah. So, and I think, yeah, so I didn't go, I wasn't with these comrades too, and I learned about what I was I learned about it afterwards. But then I would read the papers like you would read the papers, and they were making progress, right, with the Bolivarian Constitution named after Simon Bolivar, a great abolitionist. They were making progress in Bolivia. I'm sorry, the woman who was spoken about Bolivia has left. I wanted to get to know her better. And then Mexico in Oaxaca. For the last several years, a very intense efforts to form an assembly for a popular assembly for the people of Oaxaca. The place, I didn't know it, where the color red comes from. From that beetle. That beetle that could only live in a particular cactus,
right,
that came from Oaxaca. I mean, I just didn't know any of this. Most of Oaxaca is communal land. Gustavo Esteva told me. But there have been intense forms in all these places to make, to answer some of the questions that Massimo raised. And I think David did as well. Of how to negotiate among ourselves what our commons is. The different unions would get together, the different neighborhood people would get together, and they would do this in relationship to what their resources are. Now, of course, it's not the color red. I mean, people were interested, I think, in Chiapas, and when I say people, the capitalist powers were interested in Chiapas and Oaxaca from the standpoint of oil and the worldwide petroleum economy. Anyway, an effort began of constituting themselves in relationship, not just to each other, but to their resources. And that's what made me get interested in constitutions. Mm-hmm. And to begin thinking about our own when I say our own, I'm speaking as a North American whose legal tradition has a relationship to that in England. But I think all of us, in the recent period of history, have dealt with, now this is a stretch, right, have dealt with the capitalist commons in the sense of the UN, the World Bank, the NGOs. Mm-hmm. I forgot what the stretch was.
Dealing with the capitalist commons. How would
that
stretch?
So in Oaxaca, the way the capitalist, we have to do it not just commoning with ourselves, but mediating with what they have taken from us. When I say they have taken from us, capital is dead labor. That's what I learned. Capital is the labor, the product of our ancestors, of our parents, their parents. And the reappropriation of that wealth, therefore, is in a way, is a family duty. If our concept of a family is of our class. Like, I grew up with that. Okay. Enough. We must do this in relationship to the things. The race. Doesn't that mean things in Latin? The res. R-E-S. That's the products of our labor. People are thinking this way. I guess I said it the other day, you know, and now they have to think of it this way in Iraq because of the Constitution and the oil. Both, you know, what is the oil? They're thinking about it. And sooner or later, we must think about it. And I think our thinking is going to be in groups like this. But it's going to be in always local and neighborhood. People will come from Leicester. People will come from Maine. People will come from London, from Italy. And because now every local is of people from all over. These are the assemblies. We used to call them juries. And from this growth, I hope, the discussion which George, Dave, and Massimo, the questions that they raise for us, then we can begin among ourselves to find ways of reappropriating our wealth by exercising our power. There's a bit of rhetoric, huh?
Very nice. Good. That could be a last sentence of the book.
Dave, thanks for starting out with communism. What do you think we should end with?
Of course, we end with
the beginning of history.
From the beginning, yes. Well, you said it, you know, reappropriation of wealth.
Well, yeah, that's the beginning of history, isn't it? It happens all the time.
Yeah. It needs to happen a lot more.
Okay. Much more.
Okay, so we're done.
No, we have to have a discussion.
Discussion.
Okay. Discuss.
There's a question from Bob.
How far back?
What you started out with, David, that scenario that you explained about passing the wrench to, and it's tied to what you said, Massimo, about this hierarchical, you know, wage that. The scenario that you could be describing, David, is the apprentice having to pass the wrench to the skilled tradesman. And that within that, there is a hierarchy of power. That is what basically apprenticeships linked to skill are all about. And that there is a hierarchy of power, which then equates to a hierarchy of wage, which you were discussing, Massimo, in terms of this concept of where, if we talk about the commons as a factory, that within the factory itself there will be hierarchies of skill, wage, and within those hierarchies, whether we like it or not, and we have to confront this, there is always a hierarchy of power. Now, are we looking at the possibility of accepting de-skilling as a potentiality of equalization and a common way of working, or are we going to continue to skirt around this continual, what we've always had hung around our neck, this hierarchy within class based around skill and apprenticeship? You see, what I found interesting when I read a few years ago a book about the American Revolution and the secession from England, there was an apprentice's charter written by a fellow called Ebenezer Fox, and the apprentice's charter was a charter of liberty, that the apprentices thought they should remove themselves from the thraldom of others. Now, what I can't get round, and even in my own work experience I found very, very difficult to deal with, is that the bulk of the membership who I represented were unskilled, but there was a section of highly skilled individuals who I also had to represent. And the barrier between the two, going back to one of the founders of the Amalgamated Engineers Union in 1906, said that gulf will always be fixed between skill and non-skill. And that's still with us today. So I'd just like to know how we continue, or what are we going to say? Are we going to de-skill is good? That's the way I would look at it. De-skilling would remove this basic hierarchy of power and unequal wages. I don't know. I'd just like to throw that open for a response from yourself, really.
A clarification about the handing the wrench. I mean, what I was trying to get at is the internal principles of different types of relations, which in any actual circumstance, there's usually a bunch of them going on interacting in complex ways. I mean, you can share the wrench with somebody who's an equal, or you can share the wrench for a moment with somebody who's a superior, actually, but you're engaging each other in a communistic relation at that moment. It might be subsumed in a larger one, which is not that way at all. In fact, it usually is. But insofar as it's a hierarchical relation, it operates differently. And although then there's different types of hierarchies, because, I didn't get into all the categories, there's what I call self-subverting hierarchies. There are hierarchies which actually operate on a principle that is meant to destroy their own basis, which is, in theory, what an apprenticeship is supposed to do. Because ultimately, you're supposed to get them to the position where, they know everything you know, and then you're equal. And then, of course, there's other types of hierarchies which don't do that at all. So I think that, all I was introducing was the idea that we just need to get, sort of have some conception of the elementary forms and how they work so that we can figure out how they go together. Because any project of trying to reimagine a radically different society has to sort of be built out of ultimately the same pieces. And it's helpful to figure out what those even are, because we, so far we haven't even got that far.
Very briefly, the hierarchy I was referring to was not necessarily the skilled and skilled hierarchy. Has to do with the division of the working body into a wage hierarchy, the bottom, which is the unwaged work of reproduction, which on the other hand is the target, ongoing target of state policies to extract a particular labor power. Some of the hierarchies has nothing to do with skill and skills. Why a migrant tube cleaner in London, illegal migrant, tube cleaner in London, would earn £4 an hour instead of £12 an hour? That's a hierarchy which doesn't depend with skills and skills. It depends from the kind of social, political setting of migration management, which is much more complex. So the point of hierarchies is not simply incidentally within a production unit, however that, it's through the social, it's rethinking about what are what kind of activities do we value? It's some basic stuff. Cleaning and nursing and dealing with children as much more devalued than playing around with abstract symbols and brokering and shifting monetary signs around the world. That's hierarchy. It's completely crazy from a perspective of a commoning, which is of totally different type than the commoning of capital. And there are many ways we can talk about hierarchies, but it's a question of power. It's a question that that every deal that any sections of the working class can make, we should be warned about what section is left out and will carry the can of that deal. It's an awareness we have to have that capital ruled by dividing, and it maybe divides in forms which are not that straightforward, but they are ongoing. So hierarchies is something we've got to address as part of our commoning and claiming of the commons. There's no simple answer to this. Okay, there is a hierarchy. The apprentice and there is a hierarchy, as David says, subverts the hierarchy itself. It's a different type of hierarchies. Once someone starts to learn something, and that's in the end, he or she will come be the doctor or whoever. That's a different type of hierarchies than what we are talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what's exciting from my experience, which directly related to this. I work in an aircraft factory and all that, but there are these massive contradictions in the way. You talk about the division of skilled and unskilled labour, right? Well, in my workplace, there's a contradiction for the owners, or people who are giving the orders to people who manage the place, and that is, for example, that we start back in the 1980s, late 80s, there were strict divisions of labour and specialisation and that meant that certain groups of workers, skilled workers engineers, could extract higher wages as a result on the free market, because they had such selective skills. Now, in the 1990s, they moved in and started to talk about multi-tasked engineers and engineers that could do different tasks. Now, there was no question that one of the reasons they were doing that was because it would lower the wage rate amongst engineers. Because if you've got everybody who can do everybody else's job, then there's a bigger pool of people, not so tied to sort of this hierarchy of wages. Well, they weren't thinking, we want to flatten it for everybody's good. They wanted to bring these towers of high wages down to everybody else's level. So that's their first contradiction. But they're trying to develop the skills on a wider level. But they weren't doing it for our benefit. They were doing it for their benefit. So I would argue that a lot of those skills, and certainly where I work, a lot of those things have been broken down, or they attempted to break them down. The second thing is that in the workplace itself is that they have people knew as individuals, if they could get a job and then make it their own, they would be in a better bargaining position to get higher wages. So if you became the one bloke who could fix this or, you know, design that bit, then you could get higher wages. So as individuals, there were engineers who were playing those kind of games. The problem is the whole thing doesn't work very efficiently if you do that. You know, the more you actually specialise in skills, it doesn't always mean that it's going to be a more, you know, effective enterprise in building something. So there's lots of contradictions in this. I don't think it's as simple as saying there's skilled and unskilled labour. I think there's, you know, there's a necessary informal organisation that the workers use to build an aeroplane, right? It's the way we operate. This is the communism or the commoning that Natsumo and I are talking about. There is an informal organisation that is not understood by the management. Okay, you know, if you actually want to build an aeroplane, it's complicated. People have to work in teams. And so when you build that contradiction itself is inherent in hierarchies of wages. It's also inherent in how they are trying to get us to do things. So you know, what I'm trying to point out is that it's not, I don't think it's a simple question of there's skilled and unskilled labour, and that, you know, that is a hierarchy, and therefore, you know, kind of knocks the argument over. I don't think it's like that at all. I think that capitalists are caught in loads of contradictions around how to actually make things, and, you know, and also the wage hierarchies that exist within that. Anyway.
Yeah.
I'd like to add something to that. So partly, like, our organisations, trade unions, actually reinforce the hierarchy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Putting a pay claimant's percentage in my workplace, I always say we should be putting in a flat rate claim. £100 extra a week, doesn't matter what grade you are, and it's always lost. Mm. So people want that hierarchy, and the union reinforced it. Also, my union, it's about reclaiming the commons. Part of my union rules and constitution, I guess lots of people don't read them, talks about ownership of the means of production. Mm. As us owning the means of production. Mm. Which then comes on to maybe my final point. Because somebody said on the panel about private ownership, state ownership. Mm. And that binary is that you have private bosses, state bosses. And we're not talking about workers' control, where we actually control production, we manage what we want, we manage our societies, and that's something that's disappeared off our political, it's disappeared off the political agenda, even on the left. Mm-hmm. We're very defensive. We defend the NHS, and that's as far as it goes, as opposed to saying, this is what we want. We just want to keep what we've got. We want something bigger and better. Mm-hmm. That's us reclaiming.
I was going to say, what I was just going to think about the last few comments, when you're looking at skilled or unskilled or less than skilled labour, almost by the time you reach the stage of talking about labour or production or talking about skills in the workplace, surely that's like the final project, that's the final product, like the end result. Surely we need to be looking at the actual root of the problem, which is education, and the fact that our education is becoming more and more expensive, i.e. it's becoming more and more difficult for people from lower wage families or from poorer backgrounds to actually get the education they want. Like, it might be possible for everyone to become an engineer because they can't afford that education, you know? And surely that's the actual root of the problem, not reducing the skills of some skilled labourers, but actually enabling people from poorer backgrounds to be able to gain those skills in the first place, rather than actually sort of destroying the skilled labourers we do have. Surely opening it up as a something that's available to everybody, which at the moment we're slipping away from. It's actually not available to everyone. It's becoming that education is only available to the wealthier.
I'd just like to, for those two comments, what's going on here is an attempt that's been developing for a long time to try to open up the question of that sense of political suffocation that you're describing, right? This is what we're trying to do. And in fact, how we're trying to do it is by recognizing that all over the planet there is an enormous amount of common property, commoning going on, life that lives without either private property or the state, or not without, but certainly with something else. And the question is how we open that space up. Okay, that's the political project that we're talking about here. So it might be that historically speaking, the doors have shut. Okay, I don't know. Or the doors have shut in your particular part of the division of labor. I just don't know. It sounds like you feeling like that there's no hope there. Or the hope that's there is utopian. It's on the paper. It's written in. You have the right to the means of production, but it's like the constitutions of these of cloud cuckoo lands, right? It's there, but it doesn't do anything. So I would just simply say, on the other side, that what we're doing here is bringing powers from outside of the particular part of the division labor that you're talking about, and saying it's those powers can be of help. All right, so that's the first thing, and I think that the second part, the second contribution is also really quite crucial, especially for us. As you noticed, we're all teachers too, right? That's part of our division of labor, right? And what you're describing is certainly a worldwide phenomenon as well. It's not only happening here in Britain. The United States, it's like it's a scandal what's going on with student education, debt slavery that students are experiencing. These are common features, but it's also happening in Nigeria and many parts of Africa. What's happened with university education, with the increase in the cost of it, basically, and the inability of the millions and millions of youth from participating in this in a great common, the common of knowledge, because it's in order to participate in that common, you need to know something in order to know, and that preliminary process is now becoming more and more a barrier to more and more people. So I'm on the other side here too, there is an enormous struggle going on. And it's a struggle that I've been certainly following in Africa and in the United States. And it's by no means over, that particular struggle, as far as I can say. So anyway, but our issue here, at least I think, is the possibilities, the powers, and then and perhaps the limits of the discussion of the commons, of the term, of the concept. Does it, like, for example, the global commons, is that a limit for us, or can we use it for our political purposes or not? I think that's an important question, because one of the major problems with the first three internationals and the experience of those internationals had a lot to do with the critique of racism, for example. And it's been, and so therefore, peoples all over the planet, nowadays when we're looking at internationals, like the international in Chiapas, like the other internationals that have developed around the G8, when people meet in these convergences, where people from all over the planet get together and talk, there's a tremendous a political anxiety that has been the product of these other internationals, right? There's a sense of, so for example, the slogan, one no and many yeses, okay, which has been such a powerful term among the Zapatistas and the supporters, that's a term that comes from this anxiety, as well as from a recognition that if you want to find the power to launch against capital's thrust to control the planet, you're going to find that power not at the very pinnacle at these meetings, but you're going to find that power at the roots. So it seems to me that at this point in the story, I put a bet, okay, and I think my comrades here have put a bet on this is the way to begin to discuss our political organization, our local and our planetary political organization, our way of moving. This is the bet that we put, and I've spent most of my whatever time I've had, because I don't know if I have much longer. But for others, I don't know. I mean, how the you know, how much you want to put on this this story. Mm-hmm. But it's a big question to me how far it's going to go. Certainly the capitalists are feel like they've dominated the world. They're going to organize it. And they're going to, in fact, deal with this issue, the issues of global warming, for example. They're out. They got their plan, and they're going to put it into place, and they're going to use the suffering of tens of millions, in fact, perhaps of billions of people, to actually rejuvenate themselves. Okay? This is the horror, right?
Yeah.
So.
And half the Greens will be in with them as well. That's the problem.
Well, we have to be. It's a bitter struggle what we're going to get into now. Because it's going to sound like a lot of good stuff is happening. And that they're the baddies, there are lots of recalcitrant capitalists, the baddies, right? But now we know, right, also that the Rockefellers have been criticizing their brothers and sisters in Exxon, right, and saying to the Exxon, their Exxon people, after all, the Rockefellers started Exxon, that, they shouldn't be fighting global warming. They in fact should stop their recalcitrant behavior. This is a struggle within the capitalists themselves. And join the international movement to save the planet, right? Now, so when the Rockefellers are doing this, which is what's happening, it was last week when this story, it was in all the papers, you know what's going on. Okay, now we're going to ally with the Rockefellers against the bad Exxon people, right? Well, I mean, that's a losing argument, you know, already, okay? So where is our space, and how is our space to be articulated? Because are we going to articulate it as co-equals with the Rockefellers or the Exxon? Are we going to go for the UN? You're going to say, no, we're going to hit for the UN and change the UN and take it over and give a proletarian UN? Okay. Anyway, that's one of the limit stories. But before we get to the limit, I think the problematics that you just mentioned are really deep, and that we're going to have to deal with them too, not just the limit one.
Things I don't think we can depend on the state to educate us, because they're just educating us for a low wage economy and business. Mm-hmm. We have to decide what skills we need, not depend on them to skill us, because they're not skilling us.
That's for sure, okay. But that is the struggle. It's not only the struggle of entrance; it's the struggle of what are you entering for, But one thing I must say is that there is a clear struggle around that. I mean, it's not when you're in universities, when you're in high schools and so on.
It's not what we need. They're just giving us, it's a low-wage economy, £6 an hour, and there is no skill. They're just, all the educational summits are being privatized into academies, and they're run by business. So, it makes that difference between the hierarchy that much more huge. We're not going to get skilled up by going to, say, state schools.
You're going to be work disciplined.
We have to decide what we need to know ourselves, mm-hmm. not let them tell us what we need to know.
Absolutely. Well, here's where the kind of thinking that involves how you can understand knowledge as the creation of a common, and the struggle against the commodification of education. And the commodification of the products of education, which is new knowledge. That's really quite basic. On the other side, it's not all lost. I mean, right now, there's a tremendous struggle against intellectual property, and there have been some gigantic victories as far as I can see.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like, we're now walking in chains and it's over. On the contrary, as far as I see, this is a big period of struggle, and many victories have been won. The whole areas of capitalist enterprise that had presupposed the control of the internet, for example, and the reproduction process of knowledge, of music, of videos, and so on. That now has become an impossible dream. And the idea of turning the world society into an informational police state, so that the money for the entertainment companies and for the Hollywood and so on would be secured, I think that's a pipe dream of theirs. It's not going to happen. So, for example, so now the question is, there's a tremendous amount of knowledge that is now there that people are using in a variety of ways to access wealth. Okay? So our question is, how are we going to develop these types of victories into something much bigger? This is something that a lot of people are talking about now, which is creating new kinds of universities, creating new kinds of schools that will answer exactly your question, right? And using social wealth, and not just, you know, on the shoestring, but using the social wealth to actually do it. Now, these are the kind of questions that we as teachers are dealing with, and there's a discussion and action around it, really. So, and anyway, that, let me shut up.
That was good, man.
I wanted to
say,
I was just thinking about I was interested in what you were saying about John Locke, because that whole idea of it, when you're talking about the commons, it's made me think about a different way of thinking about commons, and in that actually commons can be owned as well. So rather than fighting back the land for us, it's almost like to abolish commons and go back to one before about its usufruct, isn't it? Its rights to the land. And then suddenly you're not looking at any ideas of ownership, and also ideas of skill or ideas of skill-based ownership. I mean, I'm coming from a kind of anarcho-primitivist bit from that, you know, that's just starting me off on that thought, because then you're talking about your relationship with the land itself,
mm-hmm.
starting you off on new kind of class relationships.
I started by saying that, like, we think of primitive communism as about ownership, but actually it's about access. And it doesn't really matter who they say owns it, whether it's collective or individual. The point is who gets to use it, who has access, who controls it.
Oh, right, apologies. Yeah.
It's a nice word, yes. But it's no accident that Locke moved in the way he did, because in fact, that's his problem. He wanted to be sure that usufruct, that is, you have the right to use, but you don't have the right to own. Right? Usufruct would, that, in fact, his whole point is, usufruct is not enough. Labor is not enough to bring possession. It has to be a particular kind of labor, and that a labor that will lead to accumulation. I mean, that's his idea, okay? And that's, of course, something we have to put the chop to, right? Say, if using land, if the presupposition of using land is that you make money out of it, all right? And ultimately really deal with the world market, that's certainly something that has to it can't be part of the new world. That's the Lockean story. So, but I'm not sure exactly.
I was just following up with a comment. I never thought of commons before as something that could be owned.
Oh, okay.
And when you look at it that way, you suddenly say, actually, no, I'm like questioning my whole idea of commons. It's like that idea of common ownership is the next thing, and uh-huh. actually look at it again as rights to the land and not allowing people, you know, having rights to the land that's there and
equal.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not really sure of the legal legalities at this point, but if I'm not mistaken, ultimate dominion in all of the land belongs to the state, and the state holds it, or the sovereign, which is now the people. So in theory, you know, the land belongs to all of us, so what? You know, it means nothing in practice.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true in most states. So the question is, what are the actual rights about?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's nice that they say that in theory, but this has no effect on anything really other than occasionally the state has the right to appropriate something when they want to build a road.
I think what you just said reminds me of something, sorry, I can't remember your name, that you said earlier in your talk about May Day, which was that our relationship, I can't remember his name, sorry, when you talk about May Day, you said that our relationship with Indigenous peoples reminds us with another type of relationship with property, and almost with land as well, because if you look at the way the Native Americans think about land, and they don't own it, they're borrowing it, and they're the trustees, they're looking after it for future generations. Quite
an interesting point. And that's the same with commons as well, I guess. It's not so much a question of ownership, it's the use and looking after it and maintaining it so that it will be there for the future, which is why it's quite important to be maintained. Yeah, there is this, I think former Vice President Al Gore refers to it as well. And it's a good idea, this notion of unto the seventh generation.
Mm-hmm.
That and stewardship of resources entails that kind of thinking.
Right.
I think it is important. The I was just thinking about this. It's with Sophie's comment about anarcho-primitivism. I was thinking of, in the United States, on the Pacific side of the United States, you know, with the Rocky Mountains and the Sierra Mountains, they have different climates. And a lot of recent American communist thinking comes from that region, like Gary Snyder, for instance. Or some people think of a different type of beatniks in the past comes from but very often there the American West or the earth, the mountains and the desert, became idolized, you know, became a fetishized as a, and so the almost as a fixed, you know, paradise of the past. And within that paradise, there were some Paiute Indians, or I've just been thinking about it, you know, because there's also one of the most vigorous kinds of class struggle in that part of the world. You know, I don't know whether you, but several have mentioned the industrial workers of the world, the Wobblies from there. And then in our own era, even the term California has, in Europe, has carried with it a whole set of social relations, you know, that has. You know, there's Julia Butterfly and the attempt to save, you know, some of the largest bio entities that exist in the Western Hemisphere. Some of the trees. And it's very closely related, as you were suggesting, to values from non-capitalist experience, non-capitalist people.
And in relation to that also, I think it's interesting that, like, one of the points I was just thinking about this now, because I was talking about relations which aren't mainly about things like land, but trying to understand the logic of it to bring it back to what we normally think of as commons. So one of the points that I really came out at me when talking about communist relations is they're based on an assumption of permanence.
Hmm.
You know, the reason you don't have to keep count of who's given what to whom is you assume this person will always be there for you, and you'll always do that. And similarly, you know, so implied in it is a relation of mutual sustainability, which when extended to the land has certain implications. Any genuinely communist relation through land would have to assume exactly that you know, maintenance of this thing as something permanent, as an inherent part of your relations with each other through it.
Yeah. So that, how do you apply that something like Katrina in New Orleans, and like on that scale?
Say it again.
How would you apply that idea to something like Katrina in New Orleans, and how America responded to those communities?
How would I apply what?
That idea that where there's need, need will give you that.
Right. Well, I mean, one of the interesting things about Katrina's really fascinating because, again, there was so much mutual aid going on, and the state, in a way, like, subverted and prevented it. One thing that happens, like, when you have a sort of, like, catastrophe and emergency is this sort of outbreak of spontaneous, both communistic sharing and amazing social creativity. And one of the fascinating things about Katrina is you also have this need for us to think the opposite, you know, that sort of fantasy about if there is an order, people start killing each other. There are all these stories at the time of this Hobbesian chaos. Turned out it was not, it was true. You know, we were all hearing about that at the time, these people raping and murdering each other in the stadium. And, you know, no, they actually were, people were, for the most part, like, when left to their own devices, improvising sort of rough and ready communistic relations with one another. And the state cannon basically came in and told them to cut it out. So the question is, what would be the social relations which would allow people to continue doing that?
Interesting, the collective that formed out of that, our Common Ground Collective, are really interesting, where people came in the spirit of mutual aid to assist people. And I read there's been some new legislation where if you don't have government-issued ID, you can't intervene in that sort of, if that disaster happened again, when it happened again, it's going to be harder to intervene in that way. So it seems that that was such a...
In the US,
example, it was like... It's kind of,
they're just trying to head them off. There was an anarchist group in Kansas after there was
some of the tornadoes came in to like offer mutual aid, and they were all like basically taken away by the FBI and told if they went into that town they'd all be arrested and taken away.
That's interesting. one of our mutual friends was involved in New York as a paramedic. Mm. There was a group of anarchist paramedics who went down to New Orleans the moment the disaster happened, and you know, this guy's like, you know, an anarchist and bit of a troublemaker, and he was saying to me, "Oh, it was kind of strange because we turned up in New Orleans." I mean, maybe you can paraphrase the story better than me, but he basically, we turned up. You know, we're all paramedics. We brought our stuff, and within a couple of days, we're working directly with the army.
Yeah.
And he said, and the reason was is the army trusted us better because we were actually there and doing it than they did in the state. They actually used the words "we trust you." They started to supply these anarchists with materials and resources because they said, you know, you're not spinning a story here. You're not like, you know, you've got no other interest. You're just here, and you were here first, and you're organised, and we'll deal with you. So the army had a really good relationship with the anarchists on that basis because they were well organised and they knew what they were doing. The state was in disarray. I mean, the local state was in disarray, and, you know, didn't really turn up for a while. So it was just quite interesting, you know, because there's two sides to that coin, you know. I mean,
although it's complicated, the Red Cross like was just like so ridiculously inefficient. The army guys didn't want to work with them, but the army people were supplying the anarchists were doing it on their own. They were it wasn't actually official policy because
Rumsfeld didn't improve.
Yeah, actually, there was a near mutiny in the army during Katrina because, and I knew a guy who was a helicopter pilot. You know, they were all ready to fly in rescue missions, and, you know, they were basically told, no, we have to wait till we have orders. And, you know, there were people dying on rooftops. And finally they said, fuck it, and they just went ahead. They tried to, like, arrest a couple of them, later, but they realized that there's just no way we can actually, you know, when people were just saving lives to punish them for it. So after that, they got so embarrassed, they just, like, you know, sent in every helicopter they could to save face. But it was a mutiny, and I think that a lot of that, you know, in the event of a disaster, people just put all that stuff aside, but a week later, they start reimposing, and that's the point where it all gets lost, unless you have some structure that can resist.
Over.
Okay.
All right, so yeah, cheers.